I'm sure you don't need it, but just a reminder that we'll work pretty much within the same framework as yesterday, that today will be a silent day. I'm sure you have all turned off your cell phones and don't need that reminder, but to have it as a silent day. We'll take some pause moments for any questions, any reflections. We will get some more formal practice time in. So I want to just give, before I begin the sort of material today, just again, just a sort of catch-up of what we covered yesterday, that I tried to give an overview of the Brahmaviharas, these four qualities of metta, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and just bearing in mind the way that these are really interwoven qualities, interwoven developments, even though they may be focused on specifically and individually as practices. Reminder that, you know, the primary focus is on looking at these qualities as pathways of awakening in themselves, complete in themselves, as insight practices, as well as developments of the culture of the heart, we might say. Spoke about metta and its primary, this quality of boundless befriending, or capacity to befriend. Again, I find it very difficult to find an appropriate English word for this, so I would almost encourage you to incorporate the Pali word metta into your vocabulary. But the primary insight aspect of that, really being concerned with uprooting aversion. And of course, you know, when the Buddha speaks about liberation, he speaks about, you know, the quality of our ill will being uprooted without remainder. That actually means it's not coming back. is what it's actually implying. It's uprooted. But of course, that is not where we start, and which is very much why the cultivation of metta is very much placed firmly in all of the moments where aversion or ill will arises. So it is always a relational quality, relational inwardly to our own world of reactivity, and relational outwardly, because it is the primary embodiment of ethics. Spoke about compassion and its primary insight aspect, being concerned with our own personal relationship with dukkha and our understanding of dukkha, not just of suffering, but of unsatisfactoriness, and how much we often meet dukkha actually with aversion, with refusal, that this shouldn't be happening to me. Might happen to other people, but not to me. You know, and so that kind, and the way in which our reactions to life, with its uncertainties, its changes, its losses, its moments of pain, how our relationship to all of that very much shapes who we believe ourselves to be and how we live our lives. And so compassion is both, again, relational inwardly to our own world of reactions or misunderstandings or fear of dukkha, and of course it is relational outwardly with the, you know, the world of all beings who do suffer, who do experience at times the painfulness of uncertainty and change. If any of you read, actually before I go on, did anybody go to bed with a question that kept them awake all night that is truly pressing? Yes, please.
Swallow the blame rather than renounce the blame, or
It was just a particular syntax of my teacher. You know, it wasn't particular. It's not in the... Oh, the swallow the blame. I used the phrase swallow the blame as being something that my teacher constantly encouraged me to do in relationship to developing compassion. It's not in the early text, swallow the blame. It was just particularly his way of phrasing, release it, let it go. You know, renounce it, and I know it's a phrase that probably, you know, has nuances of suppression. You know, for some people that they just swallow it, where, of course, it wasn't intended in that way at all. It was really talking about how blame keeps us fixed in an oppositional relationship, an antagonistic relationship, with others and with ourselves. Your fault, my fault. It's a kind of a dead end street. Yeah. Is that? Yeah, okay. Yes, please.
Are you going to talk about in more detail how you balance these two practices, mindfulness and
Brahmaviharas? Because, yes, I mean, the question was, am I going to speak any more about how to merge these pathways of mindfulness and the Brahmaviharas? Because yesterday I did stress, I hope you probably sounded like a broken record, the interwoven nature of sati and the Brahmaviharas. It's almost like part of that interwoven nature is implicit, but at times it's forgotten, and I really want to emphasize that. I have met people who are very, very mindful, but a little bit short on the metta front. You know, I've met people who are, so, you know, I think it's too much to assume that they will develop simultaneously, okay? Because, I mean, I think, you know, because mindfulness can get shaped or hijacked, actually, by many tendencies in terms, including controlling, being on top of, keeping a distance from. That's not actually mindfulness that's being practiced. It's usually attention regulation, okay? And we need to be, you know, it's why I highlighted so strongly the different emphasis, dimensions of sati, of mindfulness. I mean, in an ideal practice, these are interwoven. Metta is the attitude of mindfulness. Mindfulness is what allows metta to actually begin to unfold. But of course, what you deal with when you approach the landscape of meditative practices and developments is, you know, a thousand different techniques. You know, and should I do this? Should I do that? You know, should I be doing more metta practice? Should I do this? You know, and I think it can be a little bit confusing. And I think, you know, as actual practices, they have ways of being developed that are quite specific to that practice. For example, metta practice has a very specific form of development. And I think actually as people get more familiar with the landscape of practice and, you know, are aware, you know, and are not in that mind anymore of the convert mind, you know, I'm a Vipassana meditator, you know, or I'm a metta yogi. You know, when we mature a little bit and we're not in the convert mind anymore, we actually see that we're dealing with an orchestra here, you know, and we need to develop a little bit of skill in a number of different instruments. You know, so sometimes it's quite useful to, you know, almost have a meditative annual calendar, you know, that, you know, for 3 months this year, I'm really just going to focus on developing the Brahmaviharas, you know, and go into it with some depth, you know, really understand it, go into it with some depth. For, you know, 3 months of the year, I might really focus on developing my capacities for single-pointedness. Great. It's not like one practice excludes the others. They come in, but it's about what is being highlighted. And maybe that's a little bit where I start today, because I think, you know, when anyone who's been in the world of Dharma teaching for a while, you become aware of all of these different pathways. And this is not something new. The Buddha spoke about many doorways to awakening. Now, central within all of those doorways is the commitment to bringing suffering to an end and to awakening. And it's very, very important never to lose sight of that. That this is the kind of essence, this is what the Buddha stressed, this is what the entire path is about bringing suffering, distress to an end, and this quality of awakening through understanding. Now, these are interwoven. But he did speak about many, many doorways, you know, and there's one discourse where, you know, there's a gathering of arahants, you know, a gathering of very awakened beings. And somebody comes to the Buddha and he asks the question, you know, why is that person over there, you know, practicing concentration, and that person over there is cultivating metta, and that person over there is doing cemetery contemplations? And in a way, the Buddha says, well, you know, they're kind of different temperaments. They're somewhat different temperaments. And yet, if the kind of essence of the teaching is really held in the forefront of our attention, that what we are engaged in is a path of awakening. We are students of Nibbana, all of us. And the curriculum of that is dukkha. That is understanding dukkha. And if I think if we can keep that framework in our mind, it's very, very helpful. We're students of Nibbana, and the curriculum is dukkha, and the classroom is right here. It's not somewhere else. And I want to read to you a short bit of a discourse, please, which actually really actually speaks to this. This is the Buddha speaking. He says, "Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of the mind, the deliverance of the mind through nothingness, the deliverance of the mind through emptiness, and the signless deliverance of the mind, are these ways different in meaning and different in name, or are they one in meaning and different only in name? Friend, the immeasurable deliverance of mind, the deliverance of mind through nothingness, the deliverance of mind through voidness, and the signless deliverance of the mind. There is a way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name, and there is a way in which they are one in meaning and different only in name. What, friend, is the way in which these states are different in meaning and different in name? Here a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter of the world with a mind imbued with metta, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. They abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with metta, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. They abide pervading one quarter of the world with a mind imbued with compassion, abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second, the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to themselves. They abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. This is called the immeasurable deliverance of the mind." So it's really speaking about the different kind of doorways that are different in name and in times, emphasize different aspects of the Dharma. And yet they are the same in meaning. They are doorways to liberation. One thing that I tried to stress yesterday is the fact that we cannot contrive metta. We cannot contrive compassion. we learn to cultivate the conditions inwardly in which the mind will incline towards metta and incline towards compassion. And those conditions inwardly that allow that inclining are many. They are inner stillness, they are investigation, they are understanding. They are cultivations that incline the mind in a particular way. A few years ago, probably some of you remember when there was a plane crashed in the Hudson River in New York, and everyone survived. And afterwards, they did this kind of autopsy of what happened, you know, when the plane hit the water. And these different accounts came forward, almost revealing almost different tendencies, you know. And there were people, of course, who sat just frozen with panic and fear and couldn't move. There were people who stampeded towards the exits, trampling over all before them, the young and the frail and the babies and, you know, let me out of here first. And there were those who went up the aisles helping all of the frail and the vulnerable. And not being judgmental about any of these, because I'm sure we could see ourselves in any one of those positions. But probably most of us would like to be the person who goes up the aisle helping the frail and the vulnerable rather than stomping on the heads of the elderly and the babies. We would like to be that kind of person. And in a sense, none of us can really know with any certainty how we would be in that situation. But we probably can have a sense that if we actually learn to incline the mind, the heart, towards care and compassion, we're more likely to be the person. So it is a sense of, you know, how, you know, our inner patterns are often so embedded and often so invisible, actually, almost until there are trigger moments. And then we almost have a sense of really what is most deeply rooted. And it is why this path is called a path of cultivation, because it's recognizing, you know, the way the human psyche is complex and that many of our patterns are indeed very, very historical. And in a way, they feel very personal. And yet we have all the kind of many different manifestations of greed, ill will, and delusion, just as we have the seeds within each of us of very profound metta and compassion and joy and equanimity, which is why, as I mentioned yesterday, we're learning to question, really in the big moments and the small moments of our life, where we are making our home. Where we are making our home. And it's just an ongoing question for us. You know, where do we make our home? So this morning I want to start by focusing upon this quality of mudita, altruistic joy, and bearing in mind that this quality does not leave compassion or metta or mindfulness behind. It is part of that fabric. It is one of the threads in that fabric. If I just mention briefly from the get-go what the insight factors of mudita are, of joy are, and I will go into them in much more detail as we go along. There are two primary insight factors that this cultivation of joy is concerned with. The first of them is understanding the kind of ideology of insufficiency, the culture of inner lack, that I don't have enough, I'm not enough. It is, of course, a belief system inwardly that is the primary trigger for the impulse of craving. Okay, so it's the second insight element that this cultivation is really concerned with is really probing. The word in Pali is mana, again, almost really impossible to translate, but I will explain it much more. It's really the conceit of self, how we position ourselves in relationship to others. It has a lot to do with self-definition and self-identity. So these are the two primary insight factors that joy is particularly concerned with. Insufficiency and its manifestation in craving, and mana, the conceit of self. Okay, we will return to those, okay? Now, mudita, many of you will be familiar with the translation of sympathetic joy. My toes are curling as I say it. Apparently, this is really not a very accurate translation. Empathic joy might be more accurate. Altruistic joy is not too bad. Appreciative joy is also pretty good. So a little bit of reframing to begin with. Now, it's interesting. In the Brahmaviharas, this is a quality, I think, that is spoken about much less than metta or compassion or even equanimity. But it certainly doesn't occupy a more lowly place. And, you know, I think it is something easily forgotten as we kind of swim in the sea of chaos of our own minds, you know, or the difficulties that we seem to encounter, or the difficulties of life that can be very real. Joy is often forgotten. And I think sometimes we don't see always that the near enemy of sincerity and dedication is over-earnestness. Over-earnestness. You know, and, you know, I think that over-earnestness is often born of almost a sense of exaggerated responsibility. You know, I've got so much to do and so much to let go of and, you know, so much to work on and... joy is often kind of really forgotten, or it's seen as going to be somehow the outcome of all of the work that I do. You know, it's going to come later. It's a sort of like the reward for suffering now. will be joy later. You know, a friend of mine often comments, you know, my co-teachers often comments in teaching retreats in the West, you know, and looking at people doing walking meditation and how much they resemble the sort of march to the scaffold. You know, the kind of grimness that can come in the practice. And it is easy to lose sight of joy as a cultivation and as an attitude and as a climate. And I'm going to do one of my sidebars that I keep swearing I'm not going to do. But I think it has something to do with this cultivation, because I think it's very important that we all consider our orientations in practice. And I see, you know, that there are two orientations that are quite different from one another. And I think one of those orientations is, you know, the way that we have used the word meditation and work interchangeably. You know, I'm working on things. You know, I'm working on my anger. I'm, you know, working on my greed. You know, I'm working on my confusion. And it sort of has the feeling of a, you know, a kind of a chipping away at the coal face kind of orientation. You know? And I see this, I mean, I would only mention it because I encounter it so frequently in teaching. You know, I'm working. And you know, I almost expect people to come into the hall with toolboxes, you know, and overalls, you know, now I'm working. I don't see any support for this in the early texts. I just don't see any support for it. You know, in fact, there's one discourse where the Buddha encounters in the forest a man standing on one leg, and the Buddha asks the man, you know, what are you up to? And he says, I'm working my karma out. You know, and the Buddha says, well, you know, how much have you got rid of? You know, and the man says, well, I don't know. And the Buddha asks, well, how much have you got left to get rid of? And the man says, I don't know. And the Buddha says, well, how will you know when you're done? And the man says, I have no idea. And you know, the Buddha then proceeds to go into one of his, you know, you foolish man tirades, you know, that this is not a wise way to practice. But I think it actually can be a prevailing sort of view, even though the image is quite humorous. It can be quite a prevailing kind of view. And again, I think, you know, I think it's really something to consider. My practice as work, how much I've centralized myself in that, as having this responsibility to let go, this responsibility to get rid of, this responsibility to make something happen. And I do actually, the reason it concerns me is because it feels very joyless. It feels very joyless, and I wonder where the inspiration for a practice comes from, you know, where, you know, the inspiration comes from to return to our cushion, you know, when we look at it and think, oh, another bout of work, you know, and doing. And it doesn't mean that there are no difficulties, and it doesn't mean that there are not great difficulties to be understood and to be embraced. But what I see much more in the early texts is what actually I spoke about yesterday, the emphasis upon cultivation, the cultivating of the healing, the cultivating of the liberating, the cultivating of the lovely, including the Brahmaviharas, including quietude, including energy and perseverance, this cultivation of these qualities is actually what does the work. It is actually the bringing into being and the strengthening and the deepening of understanding, all of the Brahmaviharas, the stillness, the investigation. This is actually what does the releasing. And, you know, even from the Pali, there is actual, you know, the Buddha uses the word unbinding quite frequently, relinquishing, unbinding. It doesn't use the phrase let go. It's not in the vocabulary. It uses the word unbinding. And the unbinding happens through the cultivation of the lovely. Now, this is not something alien, I think, to anyone's experience here who has some practice. You know, that sometimes you can be sitting and a lot of agitation inwardly and, you know, a lot of tension inwardly, a lot of contractedness inwardly, and a difficult thought or a difficult memory comes along and it just sticks and triggers a waterfall of narrative and judgment. Another time you can be sitting with a great deal of calmness, quietude, curiosity, and exactly the same thought or exactly the same memory or image will arise, and it just passes right through. And what has changed is not the content, of course. What has changed is the landscape of mind and heart in which that content is arising. And I think we need to look to those clues within ourselves and really, in a sense, examine the orientation that we have in our practice. And, you know, the cultivation of the healing and the liberating is not some kind of denial practice, you know, that, you know, it's not everything's fine. Of course it is, there are many difficulties. But it's actually looking at the kind of attitude with which the difficulties are met and embraced. So just that little sidebar, because it comes back to joy. Joy is what brings kindness and serenity to equanimity. It teaches us to appreciate and to celebrate. and to be generous and responsive. And joy is such an important companion to compassion. You know, because it was compassion turning so directly to the reality of suffering in ourselves, in others, in the world, it can feel quite raw, and it can feel almost overwhelming. And so joy is a necessary balance to compassion. It guards the compassionate heart from being overwhelmed by the vastness of pain. And it guards compassion, joy guards compassion from selective perception. The selective perception which begins to perceive only that which is broken and imperfect. And brings into perception of all that is lovely and well. And I think a lot, and I reflect a lot upon peaceful coexistence. I mean, at this moment, you may have something in your body that's distressed or uncomfortable. And there's a part of your body that's probably quite well. We can go out into the world and we see, you know, really someone who is in terrible difficulty, and the birds still sing. There is something about the cultivation of joy which widens the field of perception rather than it being so focused only on what is imperfect, that widens the field of a perception so that we can begin to appreciate coexistence and peaceful coexistence of the many elements of our experience in any single moment. And this is a necessary cultivation. It requires reminding ourselves. It requires remembering, because we're probably all aware of just how easy it is to get sucked into the vortex of the difficult and the painful, and how the mind, the heart contracts in that, and we lose sight, actually, of peaceful coexistence. Or we get into the mind that says, you know, joy has to wait, spaciousness has to wait, or we just completely forget about those qualities altogether. Altogether. So joy actually draws on the empathic quality, that anukampa quality that is so central in compassion, that just as the heart can tremble or quiver in the face of pain, the heart, the mind can also tremble and quiver in the face of the lovely and the happiness of another. It is the same empathic quality. It is one is in response to distress, and the other is in response to happiness and to wellness and to that which is lovely. Joy has the connotation, mudita has the connotation of tenderness, of gentleness, sometimes described as being the gentle heart. Now, altruistic joy or appreciative joy in the framework of the Brahmaviharas is really the third of it. It's the third one. It really is often spoken about primarily as the capacity to celebrate and to appreciate the goodness and the lovely in others and in ourselves. I would like to stress that. And in reality, joy is the common thread that runs through all of the wholesome qualities that we are encouraged to cultivate on this path. Joy is the thread that runs through the landscape of integrity. Joy is the thread that runs through the landscape of inner collectedness. Joy is the thread that runs through the fabric of mindfulness. So it is not as if it is reserved somehow only for the Brahmaviharas. It is actually, if we want to say it in this way, it's almost like the emotional tone of the wholesome. It's almost the emotional tone of the noble, the ennobling and the lovely is the quality of joy. Now, it is an important and I think even dispensable quality to cultivate in all of our paths. We see how much mindfulness and compassion really asks us to open to and to meet the whole of our life. And when we turn to meet the difficult and the painful and the suffering in ourselves and in the world, the absence of joy, I think, puts us in peril. It puts us in danger of simply being overwhelmed or being reduced to despair or helplessness or even a kind of cynicism. So joy is an essential balancing factor, because the absence of joy, the absence of this quality in our own minds, can even seem to magnify the difficult and the painful. The focusing on suffering when it's not balanced by joy can even seem to magnify it and make it more impossible. Now, we also, and I did mention this yesterday, but it's so much part of this aspect of the Paramaviharas, appreciating the proclivity in our minds to have selective perception that is biased towards seeing what is wrong. Biased to seeing what is imperfect, biased to seeing what is broken. And, you know, see this in ourselves, how often, you know, you might walk into a room like this, and how the mind and the attention is immediately drawn to what's not quite right. You know, oh, it's a little cold, you know, the chairs are hard, you know, I could use a few pictures in here, you know. You know, how immediately the mind is drawn towards what is not quite right. Have you noticed how much this becomes our kind of conversation vehicle? You know, someone asks you, how are you? And I don't know if this is an age-related thing, but now it's the beginning of a long conversation of what is wrong, you know. What is wrong? Or you ask another person, how are you? And wouldn't it surprise you if someone just began to speak about all that was lovely times, you know? But the proclivity of the mind to focus on what is imperfect, and as I mentioned yesterday, from the perspective of evolutionary science, this was a survival mechanism. You know, you needed to know where the danger was in your world and what wasn't working well. Today, that focusing upon what is wrong is much has been much turned inwardly as well as outwardly, and becomes much the trigger for self-judgment, self-criticism, self-blame, which finds it very difficult to appreciate what is well. It is almost our contemporary ascetic practice, is the denial of joy. You know, research certainly tells us that we remember very easily the unpleasant. And we remember very easily the unpleasant. And that it requires and needs a conscious effort to hold something in your attention for 20 seconds for it to actually imprint. So you don't need to do that with the unpleasant. You know, it just imprints. But it actually needs a conscious effort to hold something in your attention for 20 seconds for it to imprint. That's not a long time. We can all manage that. You know, in terms of a practice perspective of 45 years, you know, we can all manage 20 seconds. So for 20 seconds, I actually hold the sight of the tree blossoms in my attention for them to imprint and actually affect the state of my mind. It's not just that they're imprinting, they're affecting the state of my mind. So, going on. Joy is certainly never a denial of the difficult, but a realization that our minds and our hearts are strengthened and made more serene and more malleable and more responsive by the presence of joy. It allows us to hold this coexistence. Now again, we cannot contrive joy. try it. We learn to make room for joy. We learn to make room for joy through many cultivations of stillness, of quietude, of wholeheartedness in our sense doors, through curiosity, through stillness. We learn to make room for joy. And this is so important to bear in mind. Today, so far, how much room has been made for joy? In the busyness of our lives, in the busyness of our doing, do we consciously make room for joy? It is an intentional practice. It is an intentional moments of pause in our life. Now, this word mudita has its roots in the Pali term, which is to gladden, or to liberate the heart through gladness. Now, here we are not speaking about states of exhilaration, of excitement, or rapture, although they may have traces of joy within them. We're actually speaking about an inwardly generated joy. This is one of the key factors of this cultivation in terms of insight. Because we can go through life, of course, with the hardwired belief that happiness and joy are outwardly generated. Implicit in experiences, implicit in certain events, implicit in objects, implicit in gain. And that very belief system that joy is outwardly generated, this is what turns us into hungry ghosts. This is what turns us into beings who move through this life looking outside of ourselves for what we believe to be lacking inwardly. Experience moments of success and many moments of disappointment. Looking to the world and saying, please make me happy. Make me joyful. Make me feel enough. And this, of course, was the great turning point of the Buddha, was actually really to question this ideology. Learning the source of true happiness, of true joy, enduring joy and happiness, which is born within our own minds and not of the world of conditions. This is, you know, the primary kind of basic teaching of the Buddha. This is where it all began, you know, that happiness, joy are inwardly generated and not governed by the world of conditions. It is why, you know, none of us are monastics. We live lay lives, but there is much actually that we borrow from the monastic tradition, which is very relevant and applicable to our lives as lay people. And one of the first teachings, actually the first teaching in the monastic tradition, is about contentment. You know, being content with whatever food is offered or none at all. Being content with whatever robes are offered or none at all. You know, being content with whatever accommodation is offered or none at all. It's a basic teaching of reclaiming an inner way of being that is not hostage to the world of conditions. And I think this is something that is so transferable to our lives, because we live in a discontented world. You know, we live in discontented societies of not enough, you know, not enough, need more. There's a whole, almost like a collective support for the ideology that actually we do not have within ourselves the sources of true happiness and joy. And so we easily turn into hungry ghosts. You know, some of you are familiar with that image from the Tibetan tradition. No, it's these beings, it's often portrayed as a realm of beings who go through the world, you know, and they have these tiny little mouths and these very narrow throats and these enormous bellies. So they're actually in this state of constant hunger that can't be satiated, you know, and prowling the world for satisfaction. And of course, you know, we don't look like that. But, you know, how often our eyes are hungry, how often our ears are hungry, how often our minds are hungry for something other than what is right here. something more exciting, something more gratifying, something more pleasing, something to make us happy. It is why tanha, the Pali word for craving, it translates as unquenchable thirst, unquenchable hunger. Before I really focus very, very specifically on this aspect of empathic joy, which is very much a relational quality to ourselves and to other beings, I think, like all of the Brahmaviharas, it is very important actually to really take some time to reflect on joy in a kind of much, much wider way. Because it's almost as if we need, if we're going to learn the lessons of joy, we need to learn what it is to develop a heart that can be gladdened, that can be gladdened inwardly. Just to mention that the near enemies of joy are actually excitement and exhilaration, and that the far enemies of joy are resentment and envy and jealousy. So in the Dhammapada, the text I mentioned yesterday, one of the most frequently translated early texts, there's a whole section that is dedicated to joy. So this was actually quite high on the list of the Buddha's priorities. And the Buddha, in one verse, the Buddha says, "Live in joy with friendliness, even amongst those who hate. Live in joy, in well-being, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, live in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and clinging. Know the sweet joy of the way." Know the sweet joy of the way. So what is being pointed out to, I think, in this stanza, is that joy, like all of the other Brahmaviharas, is a relational quality. It's not about a state somehow abstracted and disconnected and divorced from all other states. Live in joy amongst, in the midst of affliction, amongst the troubled. It is a relational way of being, not only with all other people, not only human relationship, but of course within all of the events and the experiences of our lives. But it is never seen to be something, a state somehow polarized or abstracted from the difficult. But again, it is within the difficult. It's easier in many ways. You know, we think it's easier to be a hermit, that we could be kind of a psychopathic hermit, you know, out there, you know, and how many, you know, how many of us in early years of practice, you know, sought to be a hermit because this was a way out of the difficult, you know, it was a way out of the difficult. I mean, the early years of my practice, you know, I lived in the Himalayan foothills, you know, which actually is, you know, by and large, by the comparison to our world, was pretty simple and it was pretty conducive, you know. Had everything I needed, in truth. But it was never enough, you know. My first house was too noisy, you know. The cows would go by once a day, you know. It was absolutely too much, you know. Move further up the mountain, you know, and another hut, you know. Oh, gosh, you know, now there's too much wind in the trees here, you know. I can never meditate here. It's too noisy. And it ended up really quite high up. And then in this hut, you know, put blankets on the windows, you know. I mean, and I had a tin roof. And there were these very large monkeys that lived out there, and they would go and jump up and down on my tin roof. And the moment I found myself outside one day shouting at these monkeys for, you know, ruining my enlightenment, I really... It took a while, but I actually got the insight there was something wrong with my approach. You know, that there was something wrong with my approach. And that's a kind of extreme example. But, you know, we engage in pretty similar endeavors much of our lives, don't we? if I could just get away from that, then it's going to be perfect. And if I got away, fix that, then I'm really going to be a good meditator, you know. And if I got rid, you know, how much we engage in very similar endeavors. And the Buddha goes on to say that it is a disciplined heart that knows true joy. That's interesting. So joy is not an accident. It's not something we bump into if we're fortunate. But again, the Buddha here is putting joy into the context of being a consciously cultivated path and a consciously cultivated inclination rather than an experience we stumble across if lucky. Now, in the early texts, the Buddha speaks about two dimensions of joy. One of them is referred to as worldly joy, and the other is referred to as unworldly joy. Now, these, or non-worldly joy, actually is better. These are not, by the way, pejorative terms. When the Buddha speaks about worldly joy, it's not a kind of dismissive statement. It is actually a recognition that there is such a thing as sensual joy. It's good to incorporate this. You know, it really is such a thing as sensual joy. The loveliness of the tree blossoms, you know, and sensual joy is one thread in the much bigger fabric of what joy is. And life would be a much poorer place without wonderful music or art or poetry or literature. You know, we delight in the laughter of a child in a beautiful sunset. We can step outside here and appreciate the beauty of the natural world. And, you know, we need not be afraid of this. You know, I mean, too many meditators are somehow afraid of this, you know, afraid that if they open that door to appreciation, they're immediately going to be launched into a clinging, grasping tirade, which can happen, absolutely can happen. We know that. But it is not preordained that sensual joy needs to be surrounded or immediately triggers clinging and grasping. Our path is actually not made more noble or more virtuous by an uninterrupted preoccupation with the imperfect. By an uninterrupted preoccupation with dukkha. I think learning to open our eyes, learning to use our sense doors wisely is a big part of joy. When the Buddha speaks about, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, bare attention really is not a workable phrase. But the Buddha does speak about wise attention and unwise attention. Yanaso manisakara and ayanaso manisakara. And he says, what is unwise attention? It is grasping at the sensory object and our associations with it. So I go outside and I see the tree blossoms and I have that moment of seeing and it's followed by, oh yes, you know, it reminds me of when I was in Hawaii, you know, and I'm going to take a branch from there and see if I can grow it at home. That is what we call grasping at the sensory object and the associations with it. Huh? This is where we lose the plot, basically. We've basically lost the plot. You know, we have personalized that sensory moment and turned it into something that it means to me. We can do this with the unpleasant also. The passing sound of a siren, it is a sound. Oh, gosh, I wonder, you know, it reminds me when I was ill, blah, blah, blah. You know, and we're all launched again through that stickiness. But what is wise attention? Not grasping at the sensory impression or our association with it. The flower is complete in itself. It's touched with our attention and then it touches us. And it's that single moment of connection. And it changes and it passes, but it's not initiating this long story and the personalization of all things, of what they mean to me. I think learning to develop wise, skillful attention is we learn lessons about stillness, and we learn lessons about receptivity, about receiving rather than pursuing. And we get a taste of joy in those moments, you know? And those tastes of joy are deeply important because they tell us something about our capacity for joy. Our capacity that lives within ourselves for appreciation and to be touched. And here we actually see the way that the cultivation of joy is really going hand in hand with sati, with mindfulness. Learning to sever the link between perception and underlying tendencies. That I can see without that triggering the underlying tendencies of craving and aversion. That I can listen without that triggering the underlying tendencies of craving and aversion. And this is one of the primary jobs of mindfulness, is to clean up the field of perception. To clean up the field of sanya. You know, William Blake once said, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. So this is where the cultivation of sati and the cultivation of joy are really working hand in hand, because it requires sati, it requires mindfulness to see wholeheartedly, to touch wholeheartedly, to listen wholeheartedly. It requires metta to stand near to that which we are receiving and being touched by. And joy is our capacity to be gladdened, for the heart to be gladdened. So this is in the realm of sensual joy, okay? Sensual appreciation. You know, it's not an encouragement to immediately step outside, you know, and find every beautiful tree to look at, you know. But it is an encouragement to really be mindful of how we use our sense doors, our ears, our eyes, our mind, our touch, our taste. How we're using our sense doors, because our sense doors can be the servants of greed, hatred, and delusion. And our sense doors can also be the messengers and the way of embodying, you know, mindfulness and joy and curiosity and wholeheartedness. And I think this is really a life practice, isn't it? This is not just about what happens on a cushion. This is truly a life practice about how we're engaging in the world. Is the world there to serve my hungry ghost, impossibly? Or is the world there to be met? So have just a pause moment before we continue. Yes, please. So the question is how much the use of cell phones becomes also another messenger of that clinging, basically, to try and fix things in place and freeze things and capture things and keep things. And, you know, I cannot speak for the mind of everybody who has a cell phone, personally, and takes pictures endlessly. But it has, for, of course, many people, become the first response. You know, they speak about it, even though they're never going to look at that photo again. You know, I remember reading a wonderful poem about a person who goes for a vacation, you know, looking at the vacation through the lens of their camera. And actually, they never actually felt what it was like to be on the river or to feel the wind on their face. But I also, you know, I don't want to get on a totally anti-tech tirade here. I could do a small one, but even that one I will restrain. But we need to be aware of our own minds. how much, you know, and how much the nature of grasping at the sense doors is to want to keep, want to preserve. Almost, you know, it's almost a kind of distorted good intention, because we want to remember a moment of loveliness. But then the near enemy of that is wanting to capture that moment of loveliness, and then possibly, quite likely, missing the moment that is actually there. Could you, everybody hear that or not?
I couldn't.
Okay, so the question was in meditation, sometimes touching upon places that almost evoke a childhood memory of a kind of, in a lovely memory.
Yeah. Mm?
So the association coming in, that how that's triggering, or is that triggering a personal narrative? Is that... Well, of course, there's a personal narrative there. However, we cannot expect ourselves to erase memory in this practice. And that's not the purpose of the practice, is to somehow erase memory. Memory is a part of functional perception, okay? It is a part of functional perception. We're not going to erase that. It's what happens next that is important. You know, oh yes, that was a fantastic time when I was six, you know, and I remember, you know, my lovely friend, you know. That's actually when the difficulty is starting to arise, not with the arising or the emergence of the memory itself. Okay? It's actually what's being put on top of it. It's very much that, almost that second arrow that I was speaking about yesterday. That second arrow is not necessarily, you know, filled with anguish. The second arrow can be filled with this kind of a pleasant narrative, but it is still a second arrow. Okay, can I say a little bit more about the difference between mindfulness and attention regulation? Sadly, I think today, with the overuse of the word mindfulness, it has very much become interchangeable with attention and emotional regulation, which actually makes it very much one-dimensional. And it loses, you know, yesterday I spoke about the four aspects of mindfulness. One of them is that simple knowing, but it doesn't include the curiosity, the investigation, the reframing of the narrative. Now, attention regulation really can be cultivated, and it's a good thing for many people who have very unregulated attention, to learn how to focus. To learn a present moment focus. But it's only a sliver of what mindfulness is. And it's basically through about learning how to focus. Sorry, does that answer your question?
Yeah, is there somewhere I can, because I get instruction, you know, to practice mindfulness in movement. And then there's somewhere I can
I can probably, yeah, is there some way you can learn more about the fullness of mindfulness? I mean, I think Anayo's book on the Satipatthana is really a good guide to that. You have to be prepared to take it on. Take some slow reading there, but very important reading. Anayo on the Satipatthana would give you probably the best overview of sati. Yes, please.
I'm looking for the Coles Notes version on cultivating joy. So, okay, what I got from you on that is being content with what is offered. or gratitude for what maybe that as a practice, is there another something that I missed along the way?
Well, we haven't finished yet. We've only actually done the first aspect of joy so far.
More to come.
More to come.
One other quick
question. It's very soon.
Climbing the mountain, meditation, climbing the mountain without study is like climbing the mountain without arms. Can one be over-focused on study?
Of course. I mean, the question is, can one be over-focused on study, you know, climbing the mountain without arms? Of course, you can be over-focused on obsessed with anything in this life. It's how the mind works. It likes to preference, and it likes to become, be selective. And, you know, so the clues are pretty clear because you will notice a distinct lack of embodiment. Like climbing the mountain with only arms, you would notice a distinct lack of embodiment. So the Buddha actually always put these together, you know, both the reflective, the contemplative, the learning, and then the investigation and the embodiment. You cannot select one aspect of that package and think you've got it all. We need them all.